Good evening and welcome, dear ones. Let us begin in prayer. In the name of God, Creator, Father, Transcendent, and in the name of the Holy Spirit, indwelling the Holy Living Trinity, to whom we live and move and have our being. Amen. So good evening and welcome. Our Christ candle is lit as a symbol of the light that is always with us and within all creation as a central being. We abide in a living body with accesses to all of the influences streaming through levels to reach us, influences from the highest realms, from all of the teachers in our lineage. And for tonight's opening reflection, we turn to Mr. Gurdjieff. And this message is taken from his talks that he gave in 1949 to about 1946. It is a time that we are told that he was becoming increasingly more religious in his expressions. He himself was attending daily services in the Orthodox tradition, and his writings and teachings and times were getting quieter. So he tells us, this comes from some of the talks that he gave in small group meetings. He says, "I will give you a sacred secret. You remember Beelzebub. There are two currents, two rivers. You have to cross from one to the other. You are like fish whose natural element is water and who are obliged to live in the air. You must now learn to live in both currents at once. There is the habitual current, which is ordinary life in which you live. And then in you must exist the other current, the second current, which is your interior life. Up until now, you have had contact with yourself only when you were alone and quiet. But now you must learn with others. When you are with a person, remain in your own current, your own interior current." Jean de Salzman once said that it would be necessary to work without respite, to form a nucleus of people capable through its being and its objectivity and its devotion, and committing to the demands that it would make on itself of sustaining the current that has been created, and to do so on behalf of all humanity. One cannot help but think that that's part of what has been given to us to do. That is part of why we're here and how we are to go forth and place ourselves under the canopy of the work with intention. It matters for all of creation, especially at this time. So let us enter that place of stillness of being, of inner tranquility, in wonder at the grandeur of our cosmos, our world, our worlds. Let us again prepare ourselves to listen for these influences, these ideas, in order to have our emotional center enlivened with valuation for the influences and to allow themselves to penetrate. We receive all with a sense of awe, in receptivity and utmost reverence. So with back upright, and heart open. Mind in directed attention. We breathe. We breathe in deeply all every most hidden part of our being. All being. Everything. Everything that is hurt. Everything that seems dark, harsh, shameful, maimed, ugly, irreparably damaged, diseased, unforgiving and unforgivable, resentful, resistant, apathetic, everything. Everything in the whole pain body of creation. We carry it, hold it, as offering. Lift it, transubstantiate it in faith, in hope, and in love. In our own being as whole, as lovely, as radiant, as loved. I do this on behalf of everyone and everything, and I breathe out this healing light into the world, all worlds. I am. I wish. I can work. And thus I hand over all the complexities of the day, the plans for tomorrow, the anxieties and small fears of my heart. I lay down my constructed life in order to yield to the divine human life. And I stand unencumbered before God and one another. Lord, have mercy on us. And we enter into Lectio Divina. And receive the words from today and take them into our heart and into our being. And I will read the passage three times with a silent pause in between each reading. And Jesus saw a great multitude and was moved with compassion for them. So he began to teach them many things. Think like a man. Think about helping your neighbor with all your heart, with real pity. Do you want him to eat well? First, convince yourself, collect yourself inside and pray, I am, I want to be, for him. And believe me, before he has taken 10 steps into the street, he will meet someone who will give him something to eat. This is the law. Such is the power of feeling pity, of wishing, of loving with the whole of one's presence. To have an effective wish is not easy. Rather, it is a real action, possible only for the one on the path of conscious evolution, able to self-remember in Christ. And Jesus saw a great multitude and was moved with compassion for them. So he began to teach them many things. Think like a man. Think about helping your neighbor with all your heart, with real pity. Do you want him to eat well? First, convince yourself, collecting yourself inside and pray, I am, I want to be for him. And believe me, before he has taken 10 steps into the street, he will meet someone who will give him something to eat. This is the law. Such is the power of feeling pity, of wishing, of loving with the whole of one's presence. To have an effective wish is not easy. Rather, it is a real action, possible only for one on the path of conscious evolution, able to self-remember in Christ. And Jesus saw a great multitude and was moved with compassion for them. So he began to teach them many things. Think like a man. Think about helping your neighbor with all your heart, with real pity. Do you want him to eat well? First, convince yourself, collect yourself inside, and pray, I am. I want to be for him. And believe me, before he has taken 10 steps into the street, he will meet someone who will give him something to eat. This is a law. Such is the power of feeling pity, of wishing, of loving with the whole of one's presence. To have an effective wish is not easy. Rather, it is a real action, possible only for one on the path of conscious evolution, able to self-remember in Christ. And so it is. So we will now stop sharing and invite you to share your own reflections, the thoughts of your heart that came to you from this passage, its reading, or the artwork, how it spoke to you. Yes, Steve, welcome.
Well, I've been thinking a lot about how the emotional center sort of builds on the emotion that you happen to have at the moment. And then you have negative emotion, and Maurice Nicol always had those accounts where then you stub your toe and then you knock the teapot off the stove, and just things keep happening, bad things keep happening. But the reverse can be true as well. And it does require sometimes a little effort to stand outside yourself and think of someone else. But once you do, it's like Cynthia Bourgeau said that the heart's native language is affectivity. And it's a deep perception in feelingness. And once you step into that, it just flows naturally. It can be interrupted, but so I just think about how emotional center can be kind of propelled and accelerated in the positive direction with deep external consideration and feeling of others, because it feels good. It just feels good to be part of the kinetic love wheel, so to speak. So,
indeed. Thank you, Steve. Tracy, good evening.
Good evening. I want to be for him, was what spoke to me. And each time I took it deeper, and I realized that the food might not be in physical form. It might be a food that's delivered of spirit. It could be anything, a smile, or something very profound, deep realization. And I also saw that when I said each time I want to be, that I was the other, that it was at that level of food, it was all one. Yeah.
Yes.
Beautiful.
Yes. It's beautiful. Yes. Thank you, Tracy. Thank you for that food for us. Jackie. You're still muted, Jackie. There you go.
Okay. The same words, I am, I want to be for him, is what, I don't use those words, but that's the feeling I get whenever we have prayer requests for our communities or for our family or friends. Mm-hmm. And this to me is self-remembering in Christ. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Jackie. David, please.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Wonderful to see everybody. The phrase that caught my attention on the first reading was at the bottom when it said, it is real action. And it was talking about effective wish. And I think the word real really caught my attention the most, because as a work student, we hear about, you know, real aim, real wish, real conscience. And so it has a different kind of meaning for me now, that yes. word, than it used to. And so when I hear this, it is real action. It sounds like, now that's action with substance. Mm-hmm. And how can a wish be action? You know, it sounds like some kind of mental activity. And so for effective wish to be real action is really saying something powerful to me. And, you know, as I was reading the email this morning, it made me think about real conscience and even, you know, full consciousness. And when those two are activated in me, then perhaps I can make an effective wish and it will be real action. And this Lexia also made me think about how when I'm being of service, or what I would call being of service, when I'm in the act of doing something for others, it often has an agenda attached to it that's you know, my agenda. And I don't think that's what effective wish is. And you know, it's calling in higher influences than whatever this one can manifest. So kind of humbling.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Thank you, David. And Billy will close this part of the sharing with you.
Hello.
Hello.
What caught my attention was, first convince yourself. Mm-hmm. And it brought to mind something I read several years ago called The Lost Mode of Prayer by Greg Braden. And he tells a story at the beginning of his writing about visiting a Native American friend and going out onto the desert to pray rain. And they walked out there, and his friend just stood there, and Greg Braden was sitting on a rock, and he just stood there, and the guy turned around and said, okay, let's go. And he was like, well, wait a minute, I thought we were going to pray for rain. He said, I didn't say pray for rain, I said pray rain. And then he described how he used all of his senses and, you know, smell, taste, all of his senses to experience rain. And that's what this reminded me of, is that three-centered, a full-body, three-centered experience is how to pray effectively. And from the time that I read that on, I had a completely different take on what prayer was. And up to that point, if someone said, I'll pray for you, I'd be like, no, thank you. No.
Oh, thank you so much, Billy. We'll say amen to that. And thank you to everyone for the sharings, for your presence, your receptivity. We'll just take it all and hold it in our being. So this evening, now I am very pleased to welcome again Robin Bloor, who will speak to us of perhaps a surprising and infrequent term in the work, compassion. You might also recall that Robin began studying the work in England in the late 1980s and was a student of Rita Hands, who herself was a student of Mr. Gurdjieff. Robin has written a number of books, and he is currently blessing us by facilitating and leading a Wednesday night class on Beelzebub Tales. So I'm delighted and very pleased to welcome you back, Robin. Good evening.
Good evening. And I must thank you for the introduction. You always set a one, well, I've only done this once before, but you set a wonderful tone last time and you set a wonderful tone this time. And it has an impact on me in the sense that I will probably present what I'm trying to present in a different way now, simply because of the thoughts that have been stimulated and the feelings that have been stimulated. So anyway, I'll try to share the screen. I hope everyone can see that.
Yes, we can see that.
Okay. So, compassion and the work. And really the process that I'm going to go through here is, it is the case in my experience with the work that we did not start with the emotional side, we started with the physical side. And so I'm going to walk through that as if it were a pilgrimage, because there is a point, or there was a point in my experience, I can only really speak for myself, there's a point in my experience where suddenly the work became emotional and the meaning of everything changed, really quite significantly. So here is the journey. I think of it as a pilgrimage. We inevitably start in some way or other with self-observation. We come to a conclusion that we have multiple personalities with which we face life. This was my path. At a particular point in time, the question of attitude arose, and it became perhaps the defining point in everything that happened afterwards. The non-expression of negative emotion, which is something that everybody, let's say, starts the work with, in the sense that I think every group that I've ever heard of says that, you know, from day one you attempt the non-expression of negative emotion. But it actually is an exercise that changes its character over time. Then I'm going to talk about conscious labours. Ask the question, what is the work? Talk about compassion and work on emotion. And then talk about Lord have mercy. So this is from Gurdjieff. Self-observation brings man to the realization of the necessity of self-change. And in observing himself, a man notices that self-observation itself brings about certain changes in his inner processes. He begins to understand that self-observation is an instrument of self-change, a means of awakening. So the question arises, what is self-observation? Well, this is what I'm about to just walk through, is the technique that was brought to America by Oraj in the 1920s, which, if I understand it correctly, came from Gajiv. Self-observation isn't something you can just do. It's a method that has to be learned. It's a procedure, if you like. It's not possible to self-observe without self-remembering. So self-remembering comes first. One has to appreciate, let's call it the third state. One has to appreciate the third state and know mechanisms that might get you there in order for you even to begin to self-observe. Most people pretend to self-observe. This is just very common, and it's common with people who have been in the work for a very long period of time, that what was a genuine effort has become, if you like, a mirrored effort, something that isn't entirely genuine. They aren't really self-observing, but they are noticing. Self-observation, it needs to be carried out if it's to be done to maximum effect. It needs to be carried out in the following ways: without any self-criticism, without any judgment, right or wrong, of what you see, without any analysis of anything that you noticed, without any effort to change anything that you saw, and with all the senses, so that if perhaps you see something about yourself, you try to widen it so that the whole of your physical body is involved in the observation of self. And there are five distinct dimensions of self-observation, and it was regarded as difficult enough that we should break it down. So the first thing is that we do gestures with our arms particularly. We may do gestures with the head, we may do gestures with the legs or with the body, but we do things that we would call gestures. What's characteristic of a gesture is a movement that doesn't alter your posture particularly. It begins and it ends, but you stay in the same posture. Then there is posture. Your body assumes particular postures, and you eventually realize that actually your emotions and your intellect go with that. They normally conform with the posture that you're in. But observation of posture, it can be a focus and should be a focus. Then the movement from posture to posture, it indicates something about your nature, that you go from one position to another position. And this is why Mr. Gajiv invented the stop exercise, by shouting stop and by individuals being under the command, putting themselves under the command of something else. They would be caught mid-posture, and being caught mid-posture, they would be able to see something about themselves that they'd never seen before. Facial expressions, the facial expressions are really the mirror of the emotions. It's almost completely absorbing. If you try to observe facial expressions, it's very difficult to be observing anything else at the same time. And then finally, tone of voice. So the idea of self-observation, the way the original Oraj groups did it, was that they would just focus on one of these at a time. This week it will be gestures, next week it will be posture. You know, in 3 weeks' time it may be tone of voice, and so on. And then, after doing that, they would start to put them together, so tone of voice and facial expression going together, to build up a complete observation. So the interesting thing about this is that, because they were the only groups that I'm aware of anyway that actually did this, their results in terms of being able to see themselves were much more detailed than would normally happen with those groups. Anyway, it isn't long before you realize that we have not one personality, but we have many personalities. It's not, it was never an attractive idea to me, but you know, you would find yourself in a situation and you would realize you're behaving in a way with one person that you would never behave with a different person. So you realize that you were meeting different situations with different personalities. And you could start to analyze them actually if you really wanted to. This is my family set of personalities. These are my friend personalities. This is my, you know, at the office or workplace personality. This is when I'm on holiday and so on. And they are, in those particular divisions, are often really quite different people. Seeing this should be a shock to parts of ourselves that believe we had some kind of unity. And this is probably the first of many such shocks. We eventually have to admit that we really are like this. And some of these eyes have bad habits, but we can't simply change them. And it's normal in the early days to waste time trying to change them, but there's a very specific method to changing specific parts of oneself. And you can't just do it by wishing it different. So this is one of the things that I was told, and I was told it very early in the work by Rina Hans. There is nothing you can change, nothing at all, except attitude. But if you can change attitude, then everything can change. And I have lived with this now for decades, and I understand it more and more in terms of the truth that it is. But of course, in order to understand the truth that it is, you have to be able to at least observe what an attitude is. So the non-expression of negative emotions, usually the first exercise, initially it's actually impossible. If you've ever looked into the idea of micro-expressions, you realize that if you have a negative emotion internally, it will flit across your face. You may be able to stop the gross expression of it. You may be able to keep in anything that was like pressing for you to push into the world, but you will not be able to stop expressing it. So the non-expression of negative emotions, after a fashion, is a huge demand that's put on people. Eventually, I believe it's possible, right? But in the first, you know, in the first decade or so, we can only go so far. But we can certainly begin not infecting others with negative emotions. And that's the tragedy of negative emotions. They are infectious, and if you kick your children, the children kick the cat, and so on. So the idea of not infecting others is really where I began to put in a lot of effort. And there's two simple techniques for this. One of them is silence. Right? Somebody has said something, maybe it has made you sad, maybe it has made you fearful, maybe it has made you angry, it doesn't really matter. Silence. Let nothing come from your mouth. And the other thing is, if somebody is trying to, in one way or another, wishes to force some sort of interaction based on negativity, walk away. Rina Hans taught me that because one day I did something that offended her and she just walked away. She didn't say anything, she just walked away. It was devastating for me. We may be surprised how negative we often are. Once we start to observe it, we suddenly realize that there are parts of us that in one way or another we had excused or pretended didn't exist, and there they are, negative. And so let's go towards compassion. So we can define compassion. This is where, this is the origin of the word, if you like, a feeling of sorrow or deep tenderness for one who is suffering or experiencing misfortune. So the reading at the beginning, Marianne, I think was wonderful, because the idea of Christ feeling compassion for the multitude, immediately what came to my mind was the idea of feeling compassion for your many mechanical eyes. And so he wanted to teach them things. And that would be a good thing for us to do, to teach our many eyes things that perhaps they should know. In the work, we should develop compassion for our neighbour, the common man. He lives in sleep without even realising it, and there's nothing we can do to change that. So some of us are naturally idealistic, and we want, you know, when we discover some of the aspects of the work or some of the aspects of Christianity, we want other people to have them. But there isn't anything that we can do that they would have them, other than, if you like, live as purely as you can according to the ideals that you believe in. So we should be able to experience compassion for our neighbours in the work, because we know how they suffer. We know exactly how they suffer, because they're doing what we're doing. And we should be able to feel compassion for ourselves. But we may not be able to do any of these things because we may not have the right attitude. And this, for me, has become a struggle in certainly the last 3 or 4 years, is trying in one way or another to discover the right attitude for various things. The power of changing oneself lies not in the mind, but in the body, in the feelings. Unfortunately, however, our body and our feelings are so constituted that they don't care a jot about anything so long as they're happy. And this, if you like, is the attitude problem. It's easy to have, let's say, a mental intention in the thinking centre because you read something in somewhere that convinced you that a certain way of behaving would be good, but you know, being able to act on that is a different thing. Conscious labours and intentional suffering. We just take conscious labours because intentional suffering is not really part of this. The terms used by Gurdjieff in the tales to describe the first and second conscious shock. And the first conscious shock is self-remembering. And most people soon learn that they're incapable of self-remembering for long. In fact, it seems, when you start the work, it seems as though you could do more of that than you can later on. And for many years, we spend our lives living like sparrows from crumbs of self-remembering. And many people delude themselves, and they make efforts, but only in their imagination. They've lost the thread that keeps you in contact with reality. So this is, to change attitude, you must bring both your knowledge and yourself to the moment. If you do not have knowledge, it's not possible. And if you cannot bring yourself, it's not possible either. So there are two things here. There's knowledge and being. And knowledge and being must work together in order to change a particular attitude. So the question, you know, what is the word, what's your story? For every one of us, the story is different. It started in a different place and it took its own path. In other words, if you like, I've laid out, in some way or other, I've laid out my particular pilgrimage, but it isn't necessarily yours. And there may be places you visited that I've not visited and vice versa. We're all, however, heading in the same direction. No matter who helped us, we soon realized that we must do the work ourselves, or not at all. That we are responsible for doing the work. Nobody can do the work for us. True friends could do the work with us, and they might attempt in one way or another to display certain aspects of the work, not by trying to tell us, but just by demonstrating by their behavior. That's often, I mean, for me, those were the lessons that were most powerful, where somebody demonstrated a particular point, not when they talked about it. And our work is from the inner world to the outer world. We sit on the border between the inner world and the outer world. In one way or another, we're trying to create a particular attitude towards the outer world, which is that we really do not care what happens in the outer world. Particularly, we care about our ability to process what happens in the outer world. We have perhaps convinced ourselves it would be a good thing if we did, that your being attracts your life, and therefore really it's all about attention to the inner world and its response to the outer world. So work on emotion. It comes later in the work for most people. It came later in the work for me. Fact is that at some point you realize that you're mechanical. Not mechanical as you imagined it. Oh, that wasn't supposed to happen. But anyway, I'll continue. Not mechanical as you imagined yourself to be, but you really are mechanical. The aspects of yourself that you thought in one way or another were real, that it turns out that they're just mechanisms. And this continues to occur. I was advised very early on by someone who's a very good friend to me in the work, that you spend 10, 15 years feeling as though you're going backwards because you see more and more of your mechanism. And this, of course, is the entry of compassion. Most of us actually need to learn compassion. I certainly needed to learn compassion. The main technique for this, I was told, is put yourself in another person's shoes. This requires an ability to represent. The point is this, really. You see somebody, let's say you see somebody who is fearful. The technique is to try to remember a time when you were fearful in the way that they are. Or they're angry, you try to remember a time that you were angry in the way that they are. Or they're sad, you know, but you're trying to, it's almost like you're trying to act the way they are, right? And if you can do that, then you can have compassion for them because you know what they're experiencing. Compassion for yourself requires the highest part of you to feel both sorrow and tenderness for the parts of you that suffer. The suffering part is the part that feels remorse because it is less than it could be, on which cries, "Lord, have mercy." And this, I think, is one of the areas of the work that is not not well explained, I suppose. I personally, you know, for me, we used to go to, when I was back in England, we used to go to the festival hall every year to listen to the back choirs. performing St. Matthew's Passion. And there's a particular moment in St. Matthew's Passion where one of the most beautiful arias, one of the most beautiful pieces of music I've ever heard, plays, and it tears you to ribbons. And it's this. Peter, meanwhile, sat outside in the court, and there came to him a maid and said, "And thou wast also with Jesus of Galilee." But he then denied this before them all and said, "I know not what thou sayest." But when he went out to the door, he was seen by another maid who said to those who were there, "This man was also with Jesus of Nazareth." And once more did he deny it, and with an oath, "I know nothing of the man." And when a little time had passed, there came to him those who were present and said to Peter, surely thou also art one of them, for thy speech doth betray thee." Then he began to invoke a curse upon himself and to swear, "I know nothing of the man." And at this moment the cock crew. Then Peter thought back to the words of Jesus when he said unto him, "Before the cock shall have crowed, wilt thou three times thou hast denied me." And he went out and wept with great bitterness. "Have mercy, my God, for my tears' sake. Look hither, heart and eyes weep before thee bitterly." And this to me was, if you like, it was the center of gravity of everything. Because it was very easy for me to see myself as Peter, and to see myself being in one way or another cajoled by other people and denying that part of me that actually should have been there. So to think of compassion for yourself, to think of compassion for the part of you that knows that it should be more than it is and feels remorse. And I've got very little else to say other than Peter was the rock on which Christ built his church. So I'll take questions. So Stephen.
Yeah, I remember several years back when I was actively practicing in medicine and seeing patients and dealing with health issues with patients. And I realized as I went on through my practice that I had to kind of hold a little bit back with regard to my compassion, because I was always afraid it would consume me. And as a one, control was an important feature in my personality. So I was very good at performative compassion, but I wouldn't go too far with my heart because I couldn't afford to. And that's a hard thing to face. And so, you know, then I started thinking about what we talked about in the Beelzebub Tales class about consonants and how we erect consonances in ourselves, especially in Western style folks. I read up on consonants in music and how we love harmonies and polyphonic music, and it all has to sound nice. And Eastern folks, it's more of a melody and they can get away with more dissonance. We can't abide dissonance too well. It's too aggressive. And so that's why we have buffers in ourselves. We can't face all that stuff at once, and so it's sometimes it's hard to be free from that, to just have just genuine compassion. And but it's, I guess it's a way of expressing compassion for yourself too. But anyway.
And this is, I'm pleased that that you spoke up, because I come from a medical family in the sense that my mother was a nurse and my uncle, favorite uncle you'd probably say, was a heart surgeon. And it was a very, it was very necessary for both of them to have particular attitudes towards the people that they treated. I mean, my mother was, she wasn't just a nurse, she was a healer. She could heal, she had an instinct of how to heal people. And often she wouldn't even necessarily know what was wrong, but she'd fix people. But one of the things that she never did was that she never exposed herself to the people that she treated. It was like a curtain would come down. And I think it was because she was protecting herself. Because if she started to react in sympathy to whatever the malady was, it would steal her energy and make her ineffective. I don't know if you felt the same way, but you know, I think in terms of the people that are in the business of healing, I think it's an immense calling in a way. I mean, it depends on, I guess, how that progresses. But you're always sacrificing yourself in the health profession, aren't you? So, Greta? You're going to have to unmute yourself.
Yeah, I've been thinking about compassion in two different ways. On one hand, if I think about compassion as putting myself in someone else's shoes, what I really have to do is self-observe, step back, and see if I'm identified or not. Because if I'm identified, it's not really true compassion. And that identification, I think, prevents us from becoming three-centered in our compassion. That is really evincing toward another that energetic and three-centered flow that, as you pointed out with the with Gurdjieff's talking to people, if you can't give them food, give them the energy to find food. That's a true type of compassion, a non-identified, three-centered type of compassion. On the other hand, simply putting ourselves in other shoes, you have to ask yourself, well, what I wants to go in those shoes, or what I is identified with it. So I think that talking about compassion, we really have to address both issues.
Now, this is very good. I mean, I think you're completely correct. The issue one of the issues we have in the work, which it returns to us again and again and again, is that we think we are important. Mm. And you will find certain incidents occur to you. Somebody maybe gets angry with you and you snap back, or maybe they make some kind of accusation against you and you feel mortally offended. We are actually not important. We just are not important at all. And the battle with identification is the battle with our importance. It's to abandon that. You know, so there's this, I mean, I think of it, I like the fact somebody referred to Maurice Nicole is a vertical man, and I liked that, because it is that posture of verticality, that you expecting only the experience, whatever the experiences you are having, you're expecting only to go through you. You aren't expecting to take from it, you know, and you will add to it to the extent that you're able to push it in the direction of giving out from. But it isn't about you. It's about things going through you. And this is the hard thing about the work. It's a really hard thing. I remember experimenting with this. This is going to sound odd to you all, I suppose, but it doesn't really matter. I was in San Francisco, staying at a good hotel, and I noticed that there were people sleeping in the street. And I wanted to do the following. I wanted to give somebody $20. Because $20 to those people would make a difference to them, it seemed to me. Give them a dollar, it's probably not much. But give them $20 and make a difference. And I went, I woke up, you know, 5:30 in the morning, went walking around the streets with a $20 note in my hand, and I wanted to find somebody that was sleeping rough. And I found someone. And I tried to make no noise whatsoever and put $20. He was in a sleeping bag and he had, you know, he was covered over his head. And I just wanted to put it so that when he woke up he'd see it. But I made a noise. And I was like within a foot of him and I made a noise. And he thought he was being attacked. And I just dropped the $20 and walked away. I didn't say anything. Because I wanted to know what the feeling was of having done something where there couldn't be anything reflected back to you. Yeah? And I failed. But I did manage to achieve that another time, but it was more interesting when I failed. I felt as though I was the wrong person in the wrong place. But still, he still ended up with $20. But it just felt like I hadn't given him what I was trying to give him. Do you understand this? It's experimenting with your feelings, right? There are things we can do to invoke feelings, but most people are not practiced in this. But if you want to invoke fear, just remember a time that you were fearful. Just go back into your memory. Remember a time that you were fearful and the emotional center will catch it just like that. And if you want, because you're fearful, if you want to make the fear go away, remember a time that you were courageous. And the emotional center will start to go in. The horse is very easy to influence, but that is the only mechanism I know to influence the horse. But to make compassion, can you remember a time that you were compassionate? I mean, that's the question. And it's also the question of love. We attempt to love, but can you remember a time that you're really capable of love? I don't know whether that helps, but...
Yes.
Karen? Oh, Jackie. Sorry, it's Jackie next.
Thank you, Robin. Can you talk a little about the use of wish in regards to addressing a fixed attitude? What I am discovering, particularly in the last several weeks, that my fixed attitudes are so removed from my consciousness that I, without a wish, can't remove myself from them enough to even know what compassion is. And when we were looking at apatheia, and that's when we were talking about fixed attitudes, I had an experience where I actually was using part of that aim that week to ask, is this mine, to use that as a weapon in my work. And I was rebuked by a judge for that, really humiliated. And for the first time, really felt remorseful and could see that part of me that had a fixed attitude that I always knew what was right. and that others didn't. I have a similar personality type to Stephen, and I spent my childhood being told I really couldn't feel feelings, that everything that I was worth was in my intellect and in my effort. And so in the last several weeks, what I have discovered is when I have actually had an honest, sincere wish not to be this way and to ask for help, I have found myself lifted out of myself. And for the first time, I've had the feeling of compassion. I really don't know that I ever had it before, where I could actually see the other person who was on the other side of a case with me, a party, and I cared for them for the first time. I wasn't just hitting bases and carrying out my role. I knew I didn't know. I just wondered. And we all wondered together, and it was fabulous. And it was a completely different way of living.
Unknown caller.
Sorry.
That's okay. Yeah, mobile phones do that, don't they? The thing that occurs to me is this: that first of all, I never liked the word wish. Right, I know why I never liked the word wish. I never liked it because as a child you were supposed to blow out the candles on your cake. And that never made it happen. The word wish was used in that way. So whenever I think of it, I think of it as intention. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about it being intention. It's an intention is, let's say, central to me, and I'll call that a wish. So that begins. A lot of the things that make up behavior in people, it seems that some people said some things to you that they should never have said, right? Everybody has emotions. There isn't people that don't have emotions. There are people that have, in one way or another, managed to short-circuit the emotional center. So when you would feel remorse, they don't feel remorse. If you do something unkind, you should feel remorse. Mm-hmm. You know, and the word remorse, it means to bite again. You know, you should have felt it when you did it, and you should feel it again when you think about it. You should feel remorse. The thought of feeling compassion, my mother, I mean, these are things that colour you. In the days when I was a young child growing up in the place we lived in Yorkshire, but also all over the UK, there were people, you call them hobos in the United States, we call them tramps. And my mother would feed them on the doorstep. Mm. You know, and she would turn to me and she would say, "There, but for the grace of God, go I." You know, and that demonstration that there are people in difficult situations, perhaps even hopeless situations, right? And you aren't going to rescue them, but you are at least going to give them a smile and a feeling that not everything in the world is against them. And that, for me, was the beginning of the idea of compassion. But there were also situations that arose where I simply couldn't face the pain of someone else, you know, so I would avoid it, you know, and preferring to feel the shame that I would feel that I avoided it than to actually try and face it. And I think compassion is that you will actually embrace it, no matter how painful it is for you to embrace it. It doesn't mean you have to sacrifice yourself, but it does mean you have to see it for what it is. I think that's it. I'm not good at this, by the way. It's not like I'm the big expert, but I do think about it because you, in one way or another, as soon as you get into the work, you have to think about all the ways you relate to other people, you know, and work out whether they make sense, whether you have the friends you should have, and so on and so forth. It's like you reevaluate your life because you realize that the life you thought you were living isn't the life that you want, so you're going to change it. Anyway, I don't know if that helps, but it's been good to speak to you.
It helps, and I will say that being actually present with another person and actually listening to them is really important. And it's not what you do. It is just accepting them and hearing them and letting them know that you hear them.
Yeah, I think that's a big deal. I think acceptance is the beginning of love. I think, you know, what people dream of in terms of being able to love in some massive way, if you can actually accept people who are difficult to accept, you're already, I think, on the road to love. So I think that's a good point you've made.
Thank you, Robin.
So, Karen.
I really appreciated your emphasis on self-observation, the non-critical or no criticism, no judgment. What would you call those? Are those aspects of self-observation or rules? How would you refer to those characteristics?
The problem is this, is that you can observe yourself and see aspects of yourself in a kind of casual way, mostly remembering afterwards something that happened rather than seeing it in the moment. You can, and you will have coloured it. And if you are intending to alter your behaviour, right, what you just did is move the goalposts.
That's right.
So these particular precepts of, without analysis, without judgment, you know, you're just going to do this, right? You're going to see, you're not going to shrink back, oh my God, I'm such an awful person. You're not going to say anything like that. The truth is, you may see yourself behaving in a way that if you saw someone else behaving that way, you would say, what an awful person. But it isn't up to you to say that. You're looking at your mechanism. Right, and your mechanism, it just happens that your mechanism can do that. And
right, my experience is that more often than not, my observation has been completely co-opted or intercepted by judging eyes. And so I've like had to put all sorts of attention on the judging eyes to try and non-identify with them. And in the meantime, my original self-observation is just lost, and I don't know if it's useless anymore, but I don't ever go back to it because I have so much work to do to not criticize and not judge. And that group that you said focused on observations and like they got really good at it, I could benefit from that because my observations feel polluted with judgment and criticism, and like just being able to do that, you know, look at gestures or postures or tone and focus on that. I could benefit from a group like that, I think.
Yeah, that so there's two things here. One is that what they've done is broken it down. So if you were just observing, let's say the expressions on your face, or being aware of the expressions on your face, you aren't looking at all of you. So it's very difficult to come to some kind of conclusion about all of me is like this. You're just looking at that piece. So that's one way. But the thing, this might be very useful to you, I don't know, if you can use this in the right way. We do not judge, we measure. We assess and we measure. So you encounter a snake face to face, right? You do not judge the snake as being evil or anything. Let's say it's a poisonous snake. You measure and remember the nature of this, but you don't judge it. You don't start saying that this is an awful beast that must now be destroyed and so on and so forth. You just measure. And it's the same with parts of yourself, and it's the same with other people. If somebody in some way or other behaves badly towards you, right, you measure the fact that they can behave badly towards you. Now, there's two possibilities if someone behaves badly towards you. One is that you provoke them in such a way that there's perhaps some justification in their behavior, in which case you should thank them because they have shown you your own bad behavior by reflecting it in their response. Or alternatively, they had no right, because you measure and you think about it and you think, no, there wasn't any justification that they did that. In which case, you feel compassion for them. They're machines. They had no reason to do this, and yet they did it. You know, so this is a very sad thing for them and their life, you know? So you can try and work with that, because that's how I did it. You know, I was strongly influenced, but it was the St. Paul that says, judge not lest you be judged, for as you judge, so shall you be judged. Realizing that in one way or another, all of the judgment that is ever going to happen is me judging myself. You know, the rest of it is noise.
Yeah.
You know, so I think you can work with that. I mean, I certainly came a long way working with that. We do not judge, we measure. We do not criticize, we observe. You know, if somebody is a lousy singer, we can organize not to be around when they're singing, right? But there's no need for us to say, you are a terrible singer, you know? There can be conditions where you really do have to say things like that. Mostly there isn't any need, you just walk away, you know?
Well, I appreciated too the other of the precept, to not evaluate it, not assess it, like not put some therapy session around it. That's very valuable, if I can remember to not, because those are just other eyes that are wanting to have the microphone and interfere, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, that is often the case.
Mm. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Alan.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Recently, I was given the opportunity to accompany somebody through the process of decline and diminishment over a period of 2.5 to 3 years. In my mind, we were talking about standing in someone else's shoes, and also we were talking about us not doing it. My mantra over this period of time was, if I was this person, would I not want someone to accompany me or be with me? And initially there was a lot of different eyes speaking, but they, over the period of time, they slowly became quiet. Or they diminished. And I began to not take credit for kindness or practicing compassion. It wasn't me doing it anymore. It was just it being done. And it's a process. It doesn't happen overnight. You just have to pay attention and be persistent, and good things seem to happen. Go ahead.
You remind me of a certain reality of meditation, right? Which is in the way that the group that I belong to behaves is we do a 20-minute preparation in the morning where we just sit silently and try to sense our bodies and come to ourselves. You know, so it's a 20-minute meditation. What happens is you drift off, and what you learn to do is you bring yourself back. Well, really, most of the things in the work are like that, is that you learn, oh, this, I've got this part of me that stands up and wants to get applauded for doing stuff, you know. And, oh, here it is again, so I'll just walk away from that one, and I'll just rein it in. And then, you know, a few weeks later, out it comes, and you just rein it back in again, and eventually it stops coming out. You know, and an awful lot of the mechanical behaviour that we're trying not to do anymore, it's only really a matter of that technique is, oh yeah, I am going to, let's say, every now and then I just spontaneously erupt and shout. Well, I am going to do that, but you know, next time I do it, I'm going to stop dead as soon as I do it. And then a time after that, maybe nothing comes out of my mouth. And there's a time after that, maybe I manage to keep it in and my body doesn't move. But you see, I'm always reining it back. Right? We have two things to control. We have the horse to control. We have the emotions to control. And we have the body to control. And both of them are very difficult things to control. And if you give it, if for instance, you're a person that smokes, right? And you decide to not smoke. It's a very, very difficult thing to not smoke because the body tries to sabotage you. I mean, that's why people can't give things up. The body sabotages them, right? So you have to draw a line, and if it ever crosses a line, you pull it back. Crosses a line, you pull it back. This is easier to do with the body than it is to do with the emotions, because the emotions are fast. You know, it's like trying to catch a goddamn squirrel with the emotions. You know, I wasn't supposed to get upset by a comment like that, but I did already, and now I'm halfway into trying to handle being upset. It just attacked me far too fast for me to deal with. But it's the same thing, too. No? We'll bring it back. And it's the same with an awful lot of these things that we're doing. The same kind of technique applies. So, it was a wonderful thing that Mary Ann did at the beginning of this in terms of setting a mood, right? And my guess is, of course I don't know the inner workings of Mary Ann, but my guess is that she's constantly having to rein herself in order to maintain that mood that all of us actually really want. You know, as soon as that starts to influence me, I'm just sitting there and I'm just kind of in the state I want to be in, you know. And, you know, the person who's has the responsibility, right, that's the only technique they've got is, don't lose control. Just always bring it back if it goes too far. So, I mean, I'm just saying, I'm just taking a long time to agree with you, I think.
It's, well, as I found out, it's a process. One other thing I'd like to share, you were talking about the $20 gift you gave to the panhandler. I read it in a Kabbalah book once that you should give the panhandler $1. The amount's not important. It's losing your attachment to the money, and also it's not judging whether this particular person is worthy or not. And so I engaged in that practice, and I was going down the feeder road on 35 where there's hardly any room for the panhandler to stand and the cars to pass, and there was one there, and I reached in my pocket, and I didn't have any ones, but I did have a $5. And I couldn't see him, so I just handed it through the window. And when he saw it, I heard him exclaim, "Oh, wow." it was worth it. To me, it was.
Yeah, it's nice. There's one thing that we can do that we often don't think to do, which actually makes a difference to people's lives, is that we can smile at people when we meet them. It really is a nice thing to be met with a smile. You can see this in, you know, supermarkets where they've trained the checkout people to behave in a way that's going to keep the clientele happy. They greet you with a smile, you know, and it may not be particularly sincere, but it doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter because the smile works. You know, so it's kind of an interesting thing. The world could be a better place if a lot of people just improve themselves just slightly.
I'm in.
So, Dooley.
Hi, Robin. You made a distinction that really took me by surprise when you said that we have compassion for others, but can also have compassion for ourselves. It took me by surprise that I could have compassion for myself, or at least there was an eye that was very surprised, because I am not very compassionate with myself. It shows up in many ways. I've been sitting here thinking about the many ways in which it shows up. But, you know, just one way is I've been very indifferent to my body and pain. I've built up a very high tolerance for pain in my body. And I think it is related to this idea that, you know, I shouldn't have compassion or take care of myself in some ways. I think the bottom line is wondering if you can help me out to understand this a little better. My surprise, I realized that I got to do the work myself. I really would like to be more compassionate with myself.
So the thing that I noticed as being true about me is that in certain circumstances, I would treat myself worse than I treated other people. That I would, in one way or another, and I don't really know why, you know. I think I found it easier to have some kind of care, at least for some people, than for myself. If you actually think about inner considering, the more you think about it, the more stupid it is. I mean, I think inner considering is one of the great discoveries of the work, because I never knew that until I read about it. You know, but when I read about it, I instantly knew. I can't remember the top of my head. I probably could have. I've thought for a while. I inner considered a radiator. Right? It was like you could inner consider something that was inanimate. Right? Because you kind of cared. Right? You kind of cared that you hadn't polished the damn thing. Right? And how would it feel that you hadn't polished it, that you had neglected it? You know, and you can, we can do that. We can inner consider anything. But mostly, the people where we are inner considering, they don't care about us. They're just machines. They really do not care about us. It's like, we don't want, let's say we don't want a person that we encounter in the shop or something. We don't want them to feel badly about us. And therefore we behave in a certain way. But there really isn't, we don't even know what way they would like us to behave. Inner considering is imagination about what other people think about you. It's not the actual what other people think about you. So most of our behavior, which is part of inner considering, is pretending to do things sincerely that are not at all sincere, guessing that other people will like it. You know, and that's like, why are you mistreating yourself like that? Is the question. And it would be nice to feel some compassion for that part of you that feels so beaten, like a beaten dog, that it has to try and conform to its imagination about what people want from it.
Thank you.
You know, we have to see this. It's a difficult thing, but I remember when I was a teenager, I remember being appalled by the fact that certain behaviors were expected. And some of that was just a rebel in me and probably too much testosterone at that age and so on, you know. But part of it was, it seemed to me that the way that adults behaved was just completely illogical. And that they expected, my parents didn't like death, so they never exposed any of the children to it. So when my grandparents died, they didn't die, they disappeared. We didn't go to the funeral, we didn't have any kind of saying goodbye. They were just people that disappeared because our parents didn't want us to have any encounters with death. I don't know what that was about, you know? And I was just kind of like, why are they behaving in this way? You know, and what do I have to do in order to make it different? Unfortunately, at that age, all I could ever do was argue with my parents. I wasn't capable of discussing things rationally, so. But do you kind of understand what I'm saying? This kind of, most of the behaviors that you think are expected of you, the other people don't know that you think that they're expecting, that you're expected to behave that way.
Yes.
Let me give you an interesting example that I was advised in Hong Kong, right? It's just a very interesting thing. I was advised never to ask a Chinese guy directions in Hong Kong. Never. And there's a reason for it. In that particular culture, face is a big thing. They call losing face. If you ask a Chinese guy in Hong Kong directions, if he doesn't know, he'll lie to you, because he wouldn't want you thinking that he didn't know, because he would lose face. So to say I don't know would be to lose face. But to lie to you, you can get away with that. Yeah? And this is in a considering, in the whole of an awful lot of the behavior in the Far East around face and reputation is entirely that, you know. It's just in a considering. Enslaved the world. Anyway, I don't know how I'm helping you, but it's...
You did. I. You were talking about, and I know we're past time. So, but you were talking about, you know, parents and why they did things. And I can see that my mother. I don't know. She disregarded herself quite a bit too, in putting everybody else in above, and that lack of compassion for what she wanted, for her desires. This has been passed down, and I don't know if it's exactly related to lack of compassion for myself, but I can see so many things tied in together with this. Thank you.
So let me just add one thing, because I think this is kind of important. This just occurred to me, and I knew there was something in the back of my head that needed to come out. You are an essence, right? It's really unlikely that the real you is anything more than about 8 or 9 years old, possibly only 3 or 4 years old, right? And you should love that little child. You should have compassion for that little child that's trapped behind this wall of personality which dances through the world and in one way or another creates your life. But there's an essence in there, and that's the part of you that actually is capable of real emotions. So that's something you could try to work with.
And that's a wonderful way to close our evening also, Robin. That's beautiful. And we are at the close of our night. Is there a final word you would like to give us, or did you just do so?
Well, the thing that occurred to me, but it's very difficult for me to properly express this, but that there is something extremely emotional in me that has a strong attachment to Christianity. And one of the things that I just really enjoy being with you folk is that you have a similar respect, and if you like, you possibly see the same kind of extraordinary, I'm going to use the word magic, but it's the wrong word, in that.
Yes.
Because it makes people able to relate to each other who otherwise could not do so.
That's right.
And it's a wonderful thing. And I got the sense of that from the beginning. So in a kind of way, I felt as though I was being too intellectual about what I was talking about, because I really wanted to talk about the emotional side of things after you'd introduced everything. Yes, so anyway, thank you, Marianne, for setting the scene. You were wonderful.
Yes, and thank you, Robin. It's just a great blessing to have you here with us. And I will personally look forward to seeing you on Wednesday and being with you. But tonight we close with great gratitude for what we've been given and by one another. And let us join together and pray aloud wherever we are. God's love has always met and will always meet all my needs. I give freely and receive joyfully. And how blessed we are to simply remember God. Protect us, Lord, while we are awake, and watch over us as we sleep, that awake we may keep watch with Christ, and asleep rest in Christ's peace. Amen.